"Listen," said Athos, taking the young man's hand. "You know how much I love you, D'Artagnan. Had I a son, I could not love him more dearly. Well, take my advice. Renounce this woman. I do not know her, but a kind of intuition tells me that she is a lost creature, and that there is something fatal in her." "You are right," said D'Artagnan, "and I will renounce her. I will confess that this woman frightens even me." "And will you have the resolution?" asked Athos. "Yes, and at once, too," replied D'Artagnan. "You are quite right, my dear D'Artagnan," said Athos, pressing his hand with an affection almost paternal. "And God grant that this woman, who has scarcely been a part of your existence, may leave no pestilential trace upon it." And Athos bowed his head, like a man who would rather be left to his own thoughts. On reaching home, D'Artagnan found Kitty awaiting him. A month of fever would not have made a greater change in the poor girl than had been produced by an hour of jealousy and grief. She had been sent by her mistress to the Count de Wardes. Her mistress was mad with love, intoxicated with joy. She wanted to know when the Count would accord her a second interview. The pale and trembling Kitty waited there for D'Artagnan's reply. Athos had considerable influence over the young man. The counsels of his friend, cooperating with the sentiments of D'Artagnan's own heart, and with the memory of Madame Bonancieux, which was but rarely absent from him, had made him resolve, now that his pride was saved, to see her ladyship no more. As his only answer, he took a pen and wrote the following letter, which he sent, as he had done the preceding one, unsigned. "Do not reckon any more on me, madame. Now that I am becoming convalescent, I have so many interviews of the same kind to grant that I must put them into some regular order. When your turn comes round, I shall have the honour to inform you. I kiss your hands." Not a word was said about the sapphire. The Gascon wished to keep it for the present as a weapon against her ladyship. It would be wrong to judge of the actions of one age by the habits of another. The conduct, which would now be regarded as a disgrace to a man of honour, was, at that time, quite simple and natural. D'Artagnan handed the open letter to Kitty, who read it at first without understanding it, and who very nearly went mad when she read it a second time. Kitty scarcely could believe in such happiness, and D'Artagnan was obliged to repeat to her verbally the assurance which the letter gave in writing. Whatever might be the danger which, on account of the passionate character of her mistress, the poor girl incurred in delivering such a note to her ladyship, she none the less ran back as fast as her legs could carry her to the Place Royale. The heart of the kindest woman is pitiless towards a rival's pains. Her ladyship opened the letter with an eagerness equal to that with which the Abigail had brought it, but at the first words that she read, she became actually livid. Then she crushed the letter in her hand and turned with lightning in her eyes to Kitty. "What is this letter?" said she. "It is the answer to your ladyship's," said the trembling Kitty. "Impossible!" exclaimed the lady. "Impossible that a gentleman should have written such a letter to a lady!" Then suddenly she cried, "My God! Could he know—" She checked herself, shuddering. She ground her teeth. Her face was of an ashy colour. She endeavoured to take a step towards the window for air, but she could only stretch out her arms. Her strength failed her, and she sank back into an easy chair. Kitty, thinking she was fainting, rushed forward to open her corset, but raising herself up suddenly, she exclaimed, "What do you want? Why do you touch me?"
"I thought your ladyship was ill, and I wished to assist you," replied the poor damsel, frightened at the terrible expression which the countenance of her mistress had assumed.
"I unwell? Do you take me for a weak woman? When I am insulted, I do not feel unwell. I avenge myself. Do you hear?"
And she motioned to leave the room. 36. The Dream of Vengeance. In the evening, her ladyship gave orders that Monsieur D'Artagnan should be admitted as usual, as soon as he should come. But he came not. On the next morning, Kitty went again to see D'Artagnan, and told him all that had occurred on the previous day. D'Artagnan smiled. This jealous anger of her ladyship was his revenge. The patience of the indignant lady had increased by night. She renewed her orders relative to the young Gascon. But as on the preceding evening, her hopes were in vain. On the next morning, Kitty visited D'Artagnan. She was, however, no longer joyous and alert, as on the previous days, but on the contrary, overcome with grief. D'Artagnan inquired of the poor girl what ailed her, but the latter, as her sole reply, drew from her pocket a letter, which she handed to him. This letter was in her ladyship's handwriting, only, on this occasion, it was really meant for D'Artagnan, and not for Monsieur de Wardes. He opened it and read as follows. "Dear Monsieur D'Artagnan, it is wrong thus to neglect your friends, especially when about to part for so long a time. I and my brother looked for you in vain, both yesterday and the day before. Will it be the same this evening? Your very grateful, Lady de Winter."
"This is all very plain," said D'Artagnan, "and I expected this letter. My credit rises as that of the Count de Wardes falls."
"And will you go?" asked Kitty.
"Listen, my dear child," replied the Gascon, who sought to excuse himself in his own eyes for failing in his promise to Athos. "You must see that it would be imprudent to refuse so imperative an invitation. Her ladyship, on seeing that I kept away, would wonder at the cessation of my visits, and might perhaps suspect something. And who can tell the limits of such a woman's vengeance?"
"Oh, mon Dieu!" exclaimed Kitty. "You know how to represent things in such a way that you're always right. But you will go and pay your court to her again. And if you should happen to please her now, with your own face and under your true name, it will be far worse than before."
The poor girl guessed, by instinct, something of what was about to occur. D'Artagnan comforted her as well as he was able, and promised her that he would remain insensible to her ladyship's seductions. He sent word, by way of answer, that he was as grateful as man could be for her ladyship's kindness, and that he would not fail to wait upon her as she commanded. But he did not venture to write to her, lest, to her experienced eyes, he should be unable to disguise his handwriting sufficiently. At 9 o'clock, D'Artagnan was at the Place Royale. It was obvious that the servants, who were waiting in the antechamber, had already received their orders, for as soon as he had appeared, before he had even inquired if her ladyship was to be seen, one of them hastened to announce him.
"Show him in,"
said my lady, in a voice so piercing that he heard it in the antechamber. He was at once admitted.
"Not at home to anybody," said her ladyship. "Do you hear? Not to anybody."
D'Artagnan observed the lady with great curiosity. She was pale, and her eyes were heavy, either from weeping or from want of sleep. The customary lights in the room had been designedly diminished in number, and yet the young woman could not conceal the traces of the fever which had been consuming her for 2 days. D'Artagnan approached her with his usual gallantry, and she made a mighty effort to receive him, but never did a more agitated face contradict a more enchanting smile. To D'Artagnan's questions respecting her health, she replied,
"Bad, very bad."
"Then," said D'Artagnan, "I am indiscreet in coming. You are unquestionably in want of a little peace, and I will immediately retire."
"No," said her ladyship. "Remain, Monsieur D'Artagnan. Your pleasing company will, on the contrary, give me great relief."
"She has never been so charming before," thought D'Artagnan. "Let me keep upon my guard." Her ladyship assumed the most affectionate air possible, and gave the utmost charm to her conversation. At the same time, that fever, which had for a moment left her, returned, to restore the lustre to her eyes, the roses to her cheeks, and the carmine to her lips. D'Artagnan again saw the Circe, who had already encompassed him with her enchantments. Her ladyship smiled, and he felt that he would dare perdition for that smile. There was a moment during which he experienced something like remorse for what he had contrived against her. Her ladyship became, by degrees, more communicative. She asked D'Artagnan whether his heart were occupied by any love. "Alas," said he, assuming the most sentimental manner that he could, "how can you be so cruel as to ask me such a question? Me, who ever since I first saw you have only breathed and lived by you and for you." The lady smiled most strangely.
"And so you love me?" said she.
"Need I tell you so now? And have you never perceived it?"
"Yes, I have. But you know, the prouder hearts are, the more difficult they are to win."
"Ah, no difficulties can ever daunt me," replied D'Artagnan.
My only fear is of impossibilities.
Nothing is impossible, said the lady, to one who truly loves.
Nothing, madame.
Nothing, she replied.
If faith, thought D'Artagnan, the time is changed. Will the capricious creature chance to fall in love with me, and will she be disposed to give me another sapphire, equal to that she gave me for De Wardes?
Come, resumed her ladyship, let me hear what you would do to prove the love that you profess.
Everything that you can ask, command, and I am ready to obey.
Everything?
Yes, everything! Exclaimed D'Artagnan, who knew beforehand that he did not risk much by such an engagement.
Well, then, let us talk a little about it, said she, drawing her chair nearer D'Artagnan.
I am all attention, madame, said the latter.
The lady paused for a moment, thoughtful and undecided. Then, appearing to form her resolution, she said,
I have an enemy.
You, madame? Cried D'Artagnan, feigning surprise. Mon Dieu! Beautiful and good as you are, is it possible?
A mortal enemy.
Indeed?
An enemy who has so cruelly insulted me that there is war to the death between us. Can I reckon upon you as an ally?
D'Artagnan instantly perceived at what the vindictive creature was aiming.
You can, madame, said he emphatically. My arm and my life belong to you, as well as my love.
Well, then, said her ladyship, since you are as generous as you are enamored...
She hesitated.
Well? Demanded D'Artagnan.
Well,
resumed her ladyship, after a moment's silence,
cease from this day to speak of impossibilities.
Do not overwhelm me with my happiness! Exclaimed D'Artagnan, throwing himself on his knees and covering with kisses the hands which she abandoned to him.
Yes, thought the lady, avenge me on that wretch, De Wardes, and I shall easily get rid of you afterwards. Double fool, living sword blade.
Yes, thought D'Artagnan also on his side. Tell me that you love me after having so audaciously deceived me, and then... Dangerous and hypocritical woman, I will laugh at you, in concert with him whom you wish to punish by my hand.
Raising his head, D'Artagnan said,
I am ready.
You understand me then, dear D'Artagnan, said her ladyship.
I can read your every look.
Then you will, for me, employ that arm which has already gained such great renown?
Yes, instantly.
And how, said her ladyship, shall I ever repay a service so important?
Your love is the only recompense that I desire, the only one that would be worthy either of you or me, replied D'Artagnan.
Infatuated creature, said she, smiling.
Ah, exclaimed D'Artagnan, carried away for an instant by the passion which this woman had the power of exciting in his heart. Ah, your love appears to me improbable, and fearful of seeing it vanish like a dream, I am impatient to receive from your own lips the assurance of its reality.
Do you already merit such an avowal?
I am at your command, replied D'Artagnan.
Are you quite determined? Said she, with a lingering doubt.
Name the wretch who has drawn tears from your beautiful eyes.
And who has told you that there have been tears?
Exclaimed she.
I imagine so.
Women of my character never weep, replied her ladyship.
So much the better, but tell me his name.
Remember that his name is all my secret.
Yes, I must know it.
Yes, you must. See what confidence I place in you.
You overpower me with joy. What is his name?
You know it.
Indeed?
Yes.
It is not one of my friends, said he, feigning hesitation as an evidence of his ignorance.
And if it were one of your friends, would you hesitate?
Said her ladyship, whilst a threatening flash was sparkling in her eyes.
Not if it were my brother! Exclaimed D'Artagnan, as though carried away by enthusiasm.
Our Gascon advanced without danger, for he knew where he was going.
"I love your devotedness," said the lady.
"Alas, do you love only that in me?" said D'Artagnan.
"I will tell you that another time," replied she, taking his hand. And this pressure made D'Artagnan tremble, as though the fever which her ladyship endured had also infected him.
"You will love me some day, you!" exclaimed he. "Oh, if that should come to pass, the bliss will deprive me of reason!"
D'Artagnan was, in fact, intoxicated with joy, and in his temporary delirium he almost believed in the tenderness of her ladyship and in the crime of De Wardes. If the latter had been at that moment near him, he would have slain him. The lady seized the opportunity.
"He is called," she uttered in her turn.
"De Wardes, I know it," interrupted D'Artagnan.
"And how do you know it?" asked she, seizing his two hands and looking into his eyes, as if striving to read his very soul.
D'Artagnan felt that he had allowed himself to be led into a fault.
Tell me, then," she exclaimed. "How do you know it?"
"How do I know it?" repeated D'Artagnan.
"Yes,
I know it because yesterday, in a drawing room where I was, De Wardes displayed a ring which he said you gave him."
"The wretch!" exclaimed her ladyship.
It will be easily understood that this epithet resounded in the very depths of D'Artagnan's heart.
"Well,"
continued she,
"well, I will avenge you on this wretch," said D'Artagnan, giving himself the airs of Don Japhet of Armenia.
"Thanks, my brave friend," exclaimed the lady. "And when shall I be avenged?"
"Tomorrow, immediately, whenever you command."
Her ladyship was about to exclaim, "Immediately," but she reflected that such precipitation would be but little complimentary to D'Artagnan. She had, moreover, 1,000 precautions to take, and 1,000 counsels to impress on her defender, that he should avoid all explanations with the count in the presence of witnesses.
"Tomorrow," resumed D'Artagnan, "you shall be revenged, or I shall no more exist."
"No," said she, "you will revenge me, and you will not die. I know something in reference to that."
"What do you know?"
"Why, it seems to me that, in your former contest with him, you had no reason to complain of fortune."
"Fortune is a fickle jade. Today favorable, she may betray me tomorrow."
"Does this mean that you now hesitate?"
"No, I do not hesitate, God forbid, but—"
"Silence," she interrupted. "I hear my brother. It is inexpedient that he should find you here."
She rang the bell, and Kitty entered.
"Go through this door,"
said she to D'Artagnan, as she opened a small secret door,
"and return at 11 o'clock, when we can end this conversation. Kitty will conduct you to me."
As the poor girl heard these few words, she felt as if she would sink into the earth.
"Well, what are you about, mademoiselle, that you stand there as motionless as a statue? Come, show this gentleman out. Remember, at 11 tonight."
"It appears that all your appointments are for 11 o'clock, thought D'Artagnan. "It is a confirmed habit." The lady gave him her hand, which he kissed with tenderness. "Well," thought he, as he went away, scarcely replying to the reproaches of Kitty, "well, I must not make a fool of myself. Unquestionably, this woman is an abominable wretch. I must be on my guard." 37. The Lady's Secret. D'Artagnan had gone out of the hotel, instead of at once ascending to Kitty's room, there to wait for the hour of his appointment with her ladyship. He had two reasons for adopting this course. The first was that by this means he avoided the recriminations and entreaties of the girl. And the second was that he wished coolly to reflect on the secret thought of the lady, and, if possible, to penetrate it. What seemed to him most certain was that he was exposing himself to love her ladyship like a madman, whilst she, on the other hand, did not love him the least in the world, and never would. At one time he considered that the best thing to do would be to return home, and write a long letter to her ladyship, in which he would confess that, as far as he was concerned, he and De Wardes were the same individual, and, consequently, that it was only by suicide he could kill the De Wardes by whom she thought herself injured. But, with the conviction that she would still detest him, and would regard him only as a vile instrument of vengeance that she could break when it had served her turn,
The yearning to avenge himself returned to his heart. He longed to rule over the woman who had trifled with and insulted him, and wounded him also, in his sincere and pure love, by becoming an accomplice in the abduction of Madame Bonancieux. He went 5 or 6 times round the Place Royale, agitated by all these conflicting emotions, and returning every 10 paces to regard the light which was still visible through the blinds of her ladyship's apartment. It was manifest that she was not, on this occasion, in such eager haste to return into her chamber. At length it struck 11. This sound drove all irresolution from D'Artagnan's heart. He recalled each detail of the interview which he had just had with her ladyship, and, by one of those revulsions so common in similar cases, he entered the house with his heart palpitating and his head on fire, and rushed into Kitty's room. The poor girl, pale as death and trembling in every limb, would have kept D'Artagnan back, but her mistress, with her ear on the watch, had heard the noise he had made in entering, and opened the door. "Come," said she. D'Artagnan was no longer sane. He felt himself entangled in one of those fantastic intrigues which are ours in dreams. He advanced towards her ladyship, attracted by the magnetic power which the lodestone exercises over the steel. The door was closed behind them. Kitty, in her turn, rushed forwards to the door. Jealousy and fury and offended pride, all the passions, in a word, which rule the heart of an enamoured woman, impelled her to a confession. But she would be herself ruined if she confessed her participation in such a machination. And, above all, D'Artagnan would be forever lost to her. This last thought of love still urged her to the crowning sacrifice. D'Artagnan, upon his side, had surrendered himself entirely to the inspiration of vanity. It was not now a rival who was loved in his person. It was himself, apparently, to whom the love was given. A secret voice from the depths of his own heart truly told him that he was only a weapon, which was caressed until it had inflicted death. But pride and self-love and folly silenced this voice and stifled this murmur. And besides, our Gascon, with the degree of confidence which we know him to possess, compared himself with De Wardes, and inquired why, taking one consideration with another, he should not be loved for himself alone. Thanks to the influence of these thoughts, her ladyship ceased to be a woman of wicked dispositions, who had for a moment terrified him. She became a charming being, who promised to experience herself the love that she excited. Nevertheless, the lady, who had not the same motives as D'Artagnan for forgetfulness, quickly drew him from his contemplations, and recalled him to the reality of their interview. She inquired whether the measures which were to bring about a meeting with De Wardes on the next day were all definitely determined on beforehand in his own mind. But D'Artagnan, whose ideas had taken quite another course, forgot himself like a fool, and gallantly answered that it was not in her presence, when he was occupied with nothing but the happiness of seeing and of hearing her, that he could think of duels with the sword. This coldness on the only subject which interested her alarmed her ladyship, and her questions became more pressing. Then D'Artagnan, who had never seriously thought of this impossible duel, endeavoured to turn the conversation, but found himself unable. Her ladyship kept the conference within the limits that she had herself traced beforehand, with her irresistible spirit and her iron will. D'Artagnan then thought himself very clever in endeavouring to persuade her to renounce, by forgiving De Wardes, the furious projects she had formed. But at the first words that he uttered, her countenance assumed a most repulsive expression.
"Are you afraid, dear Monsieur D'Artagnan?" cried she, in a sharp and mocking voice that sounded strangely in the young man's ears.
"You cannot think so, my adored," replied D'Artagnan. "But what if this poor Count de Wardes was less culpable than you imagine?"
"In any case," said her ladyship seriously, "he has deceived me, and from that moment has deserved death."
"Then he shall die, since you condemn him," said D'Artagnan, in a tone so firm that it appeared to her ladyship the expression of an unconquerable devotion. She smiled upon him once more. "Yes, I am prepared," continued D'Artagnan, with an involuntary excitement. "But first, there is one thing of which I would fain be sure."
"What?" inquired the lady.
"That you love me."
"Your presence here is a proof of that, I think," replied she, feigning some embarrassment.
"Yes, and I am yours, body and soul. Dispose of my arm."
"Thanks, my brave defender.
And even as I prove my love by admitting you here, you will, in your turn, prove yours, will you not?
Certainly. But if you love me, as you say, resumed D'Artagnan, do you not fear anything on my account?
What can I fear?
I might be dangerously wounded, killed even.
Impossible, said the lady. You are so valiant a man, and so expert a swordsman.
Then you would not prefer, resumed D'Artagnan, a method which would equally well revenge you, yet render the combat unnecessary?
The lady looked at the young man in silence. Her clear eyes had an expression singularly malevolent.
Really, said she, I verily believe that you are now faltering again.
No, I have no hesitation, but this poor De Wardes awakens my compassion, now that you no longer love him. And it appears to me that a man must be sufficiently punished by the loss of your love without meriting further chastisement.
And who has told you that I ever loved him? Asked her ladyship.
At least I may believe, without any great folly, that you love another, replied the young man gallantly. And I repeat that I am interested in the count.
You? Demanded the lady. And why?
Because I alone know what? That he has been far less culpable towards you than you think.
Really? Said the lady, with an uneasy look. Explain yourself. For upon my word, I cannot understand what you mean.
And she looked at D'Artagnan with eyes which were gradually lighted up by a more baleful flame.
Yes, I am a man of honor, said D'Artagnan, determined now to finish what he had begun. And since you have confessed your love for me, since I am quite sure of possessing it, for I possess it, do I not?
Entirely, but proceed.
Well then, I find myself quite transformed, and a confession forces itself from me.
A confession?
If I doubted your love, I would not venture on it. But you do love me, do you not?
Undoubtedly.
Then, if through excess of love to you I had committed a fault, you would forgive me?
Perhaps so. But this confession, said she, becoming pale, what is this confession?
You had an interview with De Wardes last Thursday in this very chamber, had you not?
I? No, it is not true, said the lady, in a tone so firm, and with a countenance so impassive, that had D'Artagnan not possessed such perfect certainty, he must have doubted.
Do not lie, my beauteous angel, said D'Artagnan, endeavouring to smile. It is quite useless.
What do you mean? Speak now, for you kill me.
Oh, be at ease, you are not culpable towards me, and I have already forgiven you.
What next? What next?
De Wardes has nothing to boast of.
How? You told me yourself that this ring,
that ring, I myself have. The De Wardes of Thursday and the D'Artagnan of today are the same person.
The imprudent young man expected a surprise mixed with bashfulness, a little storm which would dissolve in tears. But he strangely deceived himself, and his error was quickly apparent. Pale and terrible, her ladyship raised herself up, and pushing away D'Artagnan, who was near her, by a violent blow on the chest, sought to hasten from him. D'Artagnan restrained her by her robe in order to implore her pardon, but with a powerful and resolute effort she endeavoured to escape. In this effort her robe gave way near the corset, and then, one of her beautiful shoulders being uncovered, D'Artagnan, with inexpressible horror, perceived upon it the fleur-de-lis, that indelible mark impressed by the degrading hand of the executioner.
"Great God!" exclaimed he, letting fall the robe, and he remained mute, motionless, and rooted to his place.
But the lady felt herself denounced, even by D'Artagnan's horror. Doubtless he had seen everything. The young man now knew her secret, that terrible secret of which the whole world was ignorant except him. She turned, no longer like a mere furious woman, but like a wounded panther.
"Ah, wretch!" said she. "You have betrayed me like a coward, and, moreover, you have learned my secret. You must die!"
and she ran to an inlaid cabinet on her toilet table, opened it with a feverish, trembling hand, drew from it a small dagger with a golden hilt and a sharp and slender blade, and returned with one bound to the side of D'Artagnan, her vesture in pieces.
This is the end of disc number 12. Please insert disc number 13. This is disc number 13.
She ran to an inlaid cabinet on her toilet table, opened it with a feverish, trembling hand, drew from it a small dagger with a golden hilt and a sharp and slender blade, and returned with one bound to the side of D'Artagnan, her vesture in pieces. Although the young man was, as we know, brave, he was frightened at that convulsed countenance, at those horrible dilated pupils, at those pale cheeks and bleeding lips. He arose and recoiled, as from the approach of a serpent that had crawled towards him, and instinctively putting his perspiring hand to his sword, he drew it from the sheath. But without being at all dismayed at the sight of the sword, her ladyship still advanced towards him to strike him, and only stopped when she felt the sharp point upon her bosom. Then she attempted to seize the sword in her hands, but D'Artagnan always withheld it from her grasp, by pointing it, without touching her, sometimes at her eyes and sometimes at her breast, whilst he still retreated, endeavouring to find the door which opened into Kitty's room. During all this time her ladyship was rushing at him in horrible transports of rage, and howling in a fearful manner. Nevertheless, as this was ending in a strong resemblance to a duel, D'Artagnan gradually recovered his coolness. "Well done, beautiful lady, well done!" said he. "But for God's sake be calm, or I will draw a second fleur-de-lis on the other shoulder." "Wretch! Wretch!" vociferated her ladyship. But D'Artagnan, still seeking the door, maintained himself on the defensive. At the noise that they made by overturning the furniture, she to get at him and he to get behind it, out of the way, Kitty opened the door. D'Artagnan, who had never ceased manoeuvring to get near this door, was only 3 paces from it. With one bound, therefore, he sprang out of the lady's chamber into that of her maid, and, as quick as lightning, closed the door again, and leaned against it with his whole weight, whilst Kitty fastened the bolts. Her ladyship then endeavoured, with a force far beyond the strength of an ordinary woman, to break down the barriers which confined her in her own room. But finding this impossible, she stabbed the door with her dagger, sometimes penetrating the entire thickness of the panels. Each blow was accompanied by some horrible imprecation. "Quick, quick, Kitty," said D'Artagnan in a whisper, when the bolts were fastened. "Make haste to let me out of the hotel, or she will have me killed by the lackeys. Let us be quick, do you hear? For it is a matter of life and death." Kitty too well understood him. She drew him down the stairs in the darkness, and it was time. Her ladyship had already rung and aroused the whole of her establishment. The porter drew the cord at Kitty's call at the very instant that his mistress screamed from the window, "Do not open!" The young man fled, whilst she still menaced him with an impotent gesture. At the same moment that she lost sight of him, she fell senseless in her chamber. 38. How, without disturbing himself, Athos obtained his equipment. D'Artagnan was so completely confounded that, without considering what would become of Kitty, he ran through half of Paris, and did not stop till he found himself at Athos's door. The confusion of his mind, the terror which spurred him on, the shouts of some of the watch who had pursued him, only made him the more expeditious in his progress. He traversed the court, mounted the 2 flights of stairs, and knocked as if he would break down the door. Grimaud opened it, with his eyes swollen by sleep, and D'Artagnan rushed into the antechamber with such violence as almost to overthrow him as he passed. This time, at any rate, in spite of his habitual taciturnity, Grimaud found his tongue. "Hullo!" he cried. "What do you want, hussy?" D'Artagnan then rid himself of the woman's hood and cloak given him to escape in by Kitty. At the sight of D'Artagnan's naked sword, the poor fellow saw that he had to deal with a man, with some assassin, perhaps. "Help! Help! Murder!" exclaimed he. "Be silent, you unlucky dog!" said the young man. "I am D'Artagnan!
Do you not know me? Where is your master?
You, Monsieur D'Artagnan! Exclaimed the panic-stricken Grimaud. Impossible!
Grimaud, said Athos, as he quietly emerged from his chamber in his dressing-gown. Grimaud, I believe that you are permitting yourself to speak.
Ah, sir, it is because...
Silence! Grimaud then contented himself with pointing to D'Artagnan with his finger. Athos, phlegmatic as he was, burst out into a fit of laughter, which was occasioned by D'Artagnan's wild appearance, hood askew, skirt falling, sleeves tucked up, moustache bristling.
"Do not laugh, my friend," exclaimed D'Artagnan. "In the name of heaven, do not laugh, for upon my soul I assure you that there is nothing to laugh at."
He uttered these words with so much solemnity, and with such undissembled horror, that Athos immediately seized his hand, saying,
"Are you wounded, my friend? You're very pale."
"No, but something very terrible has just happened to me."
"Are you alone, Athos?"
"Sans Dieu! Who would you expect to be with me at this time of night?"
"Good, good."
And D'Artagnan hurried into Athos's chamber.
"Well, speak now," said the latter, bolting the door. "Is the king dead? Have you killed the cardinal? You're altogether upset. Come, speak, for I'm dying with anxiety."
"Athos," replied D'Artagnan, "prepare to hear something perfectly incredible, unparalleled."
"Speak, then, speak," said Athos.
"Well, then,"
continued D'Artagnan, bending towards Athos's ear and whispering,
"her ladyship is branded with a fleur-de-lis upon her shoulder."
"Ah!"
exclaimed the musketeer, as if he had received a bullet in his heart.
"But are you quite sure,"
continued D'Artagnan,
"that the other is really dead?"
"The other,"
murmured Athos, in a voice so faint as scarcely to be audible.
"Yes, she of whom you told me one day at Amiens."
Athos groaned, and his head fell upon his hands.
"This one," said D'Artagnan, "is a woman of from 26 to 28 years of age."
"Blonde," said Athos.
"Yes,
with clear blue eyes of an uncommon brightness, and with black eyelashes and eyebrows."
"Yes."
"Tall and well made. Has she also lost a tooth near the eye-tooth on the left side?"
"Yes."
"The fleur-de-lis is small, of a red colour, and as if somewhat effaced by layers of paste applied to it?"
"Yes."
"And yet you say that this woman is English?"
"She is called my lady, but she may yet be a Frenchwoman. Lord de Winter is only her brother-in-law." "I must see her, D'Artagnan." "Take care, Athos, take care! You wish to kill her. She is a woman who would willingly pay you back, and is not likely to fail."
"She dare not say a word. It will be denouncing herself."
"She is equal to anything. Did you ever see her furious?"
"No," said Athos.
"A tigress, a panther. Ah, oh, my dear Athos, I fear that I've drawn down upon us both a terrible vengeance."
D'Artagnan then recounted everything, the lady's maddened rage and her menaces of death.
"You are quite right, and upon my soul I would sell my life for a hair," said Athos. "Happily, however, we leave Paris the day after tomorrow, and shall probably go to La Rochelle. Once off,
she will pursue you to the end of the world, Athos, should she recognize you. Let her, then, vent her hatred on me alone."
"Ah, my friend, what does it signify that she should kill me?" said Athos. "Do you for an instant suppose that I am at all anxious to live?"
"There is some horrible mystery under all this, Athos. I am certain that this woman is one of the cardinal's spies."
"In that case, take care of yourself. If the cardinal does not greatly admire you for that London affair, he hates you thoroughly. But as he has, all being considered, nothing to bring forward openly against you, and yet must gratify his revenge, take care of yourself. If you go out, do not go alone. If you eat, use every precaution. Distrust everything, even your own shadow."
"Happily," said D'Artagnan, "we only need to manage till tomorrow evening without accident, for when once with the army, I hope that we shall only have men to fear."
"In the meantime," said Athos, "I renounce my plan of seclusion, and shall go everywhere with you. You must return to the Rue des Fossoyeurs, and I will accompany you."
"Be it so, my dear Athos. But first, let me return to you this ring which I received from that woman. This sapphire is yours. Did you not tell me that it was a family jewel?
Yes. My father gave 2,000 crowns for it, as he formerly told me. It was a part of the marriage present that he made my mother. It is magnificent. My mother gave it to me, and instead of guarding it as a sacred relic, madman that I was, I gave it to that wretch. Well, take back your ring, for I understand that you must prize it. I take it, after it has passed through that wretch's hands. Never. The ring is polluted, D'Artagnan. Then sell it, or pledge it. You can borrow 1,000 crowns on it. With that sum, you will be well off. And then, with the first money you obtain, you can redeem it, cleansed of its ancient stains, since it will have passed through the hands of usurers.
Athos smiled. You are a charming companion, my dear D'Artagnan, said he. Your eternal gaiety revives the souls of the afflicted.
Well, then, let us pledge this ring of mine, but on one condition.
And what is that?
That you will have 500 crowns, and I shall have 500.
But think a moment, Athos. I shall not want a quarter of that sum. I, who am only in the guards, and by selling my saddles I can easily procure it. What do I really want?
A horse for Planchet, nothing more. Besides, you forget that I have a ring also, which you value even more than I do mine. At least I think that I have so observed.
Yes. For in extremities it might relieve us, not only from great embarrassment, but even from great danger. It is not only a simple diamond, it is also an enchanted talisman.
I do not understand you, yet I believe what you say. But to return to my ring, or rather ours, you shall take half the sum it may produce, or I will throw it into the Seine, and I much doubt whether, as in the case of Polycrates, a fish would be so obliging as to restore it to us.
Well, then, I agree to it, said D'Artagnan.
At this moment Grimaud came in, accompanied by Planchet, who was uneasy about his master, and anxious to know what had happened to him. Athos dressed himself, and, when he was ready to go out, made the gesture of a man taking aim to Grimaud. The latter immediately took down his carbine and prepared to follow his master. D'Artagnan and Athos, attended by their servants, reached the Rue des Fossoyeurs in safety. Monsieur Bonancieux was at his door, and looked at D'Artagnan with a bantering air.
"Hello, my dear lodger," said he. "Make haste. There is a pretty young girl waiting for you, and the women, you know, do not like to be kept waiting."
"It is Kitty," exclaimed D'Artagnan to himself, as he rushed towards the stairs.
In fact, on the landing-place before his apartment, and crouching against his door, he found the poor trembling girl. As soon as she saw him, she exclaimed,
"You promised me your protection. You promised to save me from her anger. Remember, it is you who have ruined me."
"Yes, certainly," said D'Artagnan. "Make yourself easy about that, Kitty. But what happened after I was gone?"
"I can scarcely tell," replied Kitty. "At the outcries that she made, the lackeys ran to her. She was furious with passion. Whatever can be uttered in the way of imprecation, she vomited forth against you. Then I thought you would remember that it was through my room that you had entered hers, and would take me for your accomplice. So I collected the little money that I had, and my most precious clothes, and ran hither for safety."
"Poor child! But what am I to do with you? I'm going off the day after tomorrow."
"Anything you like, sir. Send me away from Paris. Send me out of France."
"But I cannot take you with me to the siege of La Rochelle," said D'Artagnan.
"No. But you might place me in the service of some lady of your acquaintance, in your own province, for instance."
"Ah, my child, in my own province the ladies have no waiting maids. But wait, I know what I will do. Planchet, go to Aramis and ask him to come here directly. We have matters of great importance to discuss with him."
"I understand," said Athos. "But why not Porthos? It appears to me that his marchioness..."
"Porthos's marchioness! Sooner than keep a lady's maid would have her clothes put on her by her husband's clerks," said D'Artagnan, laughing. "Besides, Kitty would rather not live in the Rue aux Ours, would you, Kitty?"
"I will live where you please," said Kitty, "provided I am concealed and that nobody knows where I am."
"But, Kitty, now that we are going to be separated, and that you are therefore no longer jealous of me..."
"Sir," interrupted Kitty, "far or near, I shall never cease to love you."
"Where the plague does Constancy repair to nestle?" muttered Athos.
"And I also," said D'Artagnan. "I also shall always love you, you may be sure. But now answer me. This question is one of great importance. Did you never hear anything said about a young woman who was abducted one night?"
"Wait a minute. Oh, mon Dieu, sir, do you still love that woman?"
"No, it is one of my friends who loves her. Yes, it is Athos there."
"I?" exclaimed Athos, in a tone pretty much like that of the man who sees himself about to tread upon an adder.
"Yes, to be sure, you," said D'Artagnan, pressing Athos's hand. "You know the interest that we all take in that poor little Madame Bonacieux. Besides, Kitty will not tell, will you, Kitty? You understand, my child," exclaimed D'Artagnan, "that she is the wife of that ugly ape whom you saw upon the doorstep as you came in."
"Oh, my God!" exclaimed Kitty. "You remind me how frightened I was, lest he should have recognized me."
"How recognized? Then you have seen this man before?"
"Yes, he came twice to my lady's."
"As might be expected. About what time?"
"About a fortnight ago."
"Just about the time."
"And yesterday evening he came again."
"Yesterday evening?"
"Yes, a minute before you came yourself."
"My dear Athos, we are enveloped in a web of spies. And do you believe that he recognized you, Kitty?"
"I drew down my hood when I saw him, but perhaps it was too late."
"Go down, Athos. He suspects you less than me, and see whether he is still at the door."
Athos went down and returned immediately.
"He is gone," said he, "and the house is closed." "He is gone to make his report, and to say that all the pigeons are at this moment in the dovecot."
"Well, then, let us be off," said Athos, "leaving only Planchet here to bring us intelligence."
"Wait one instant. And what about Aramis, whom we have sent for?"
"True," said Athos. "Let us wait for Aramis." An instant afterwards Aramis entered. They explained the affair to him, and told him how urgent it was for him to find, amongst some of his high connections, a situation for Kitty.
"And will this really be a service to you, D'Artagnan?"
"I will be grateful for it forever."
"Well, then, Madame de Bois Tracy has requested me to find a trustworthy waiting maid for one of her friends, who lives in the provinces. And if you, my dear D'Artagnan, can answer for the young woman—"
"Oh, sir," exclaimed Kitty, "I shall be entirely devoted, be assured, to the lady who will give me the means of leaving Paris."
"Then," said Aramis, "nothing can be better."
He sat himself down at the table and wrote a short note, which he sealed with a ring and gave to Kitty.
"And now, my child," said D'Artagnan, "you know that this place is no safer for us than for you, so let us separate. We shall meet again in happier days."
"And at whatever time or place we may meet again, sir," said Kitty, "you will find me loving you still more than now."
"A gamester's vow," said Athos, whilst D'Artagnan was accompanying Kitty down the stairs.
A few minutes afterwards, the three friends separated, after making an appointment for 4 o'clock at Athos's chambers, and leaving Planchet to mind the house. Aramis returned home, and Athos and D'Artagnan busied themselves about pledging the sapphire. As our Gascon had foreseen, they easily procured 300 pistoles on the ring, and the Jew moreover declared that if they chose to sell it, as it would make a splendid drop for earrings, he would give as much as 500 pistoles for it. Athos and D'Artagnan, with the activity of 2 soldiers and the science of 2 connoisseurs, scarcely spent 3 hours in purchasing the equipment of the musketeer. Besides, Athos had the character and manners of a nobleman, even to his fingers' ends. Directly anything suited him, he paid for it at once, without haggling to reduce the price. D'Artagnan wished to make some objections to this, but Athos laid his hand on his shoulder, smiling, and D'Artagnan understood that it was very well for a little Gascon gentleman like him to bargain, but not for a man who had the deportment of a prince. The musketeer saw a superb Andalusian horse, as black as jet, with fiery nostrils and fine and elegant legs, rising 6 years. He examined it and found it faultless. He got it for 1,000 francs. Perhaps he might have had it for less, but while D'Artagnan was discussing the price with the dealer, Athos counted down the 100 pistoles on the table. Grimaud had a cob from Picardy, which cost 300 francs. But when the saddle of this latter horse and Grimaud's arms were bought, Athos had not one sou remaining of the 150 pistoles. D'Artagnan therefore begged his friend to bite a mouthful out of his share, which he could restore to him afterwards if he chose. But Athos only answered by shrugging his shoulders.
"How much did the Jew say he would give for the sapphire to buy it out and out?" asked he at last.
500 pistoles.
That is 200 pistoles more, 100 for each of us.
Why, that is quite a fortune. Let us go to the Jew again, my friend.
But would you really do this?
Yes, this ring would unquestionably recall memories too melancholy. Besides, we shall never have 300 pistoles to redeem it with. Therefore, we should actually lose 200 by the bargain. Go and tell him that the ring is his, D'Artagnan, and come back with the 200 pistoles.
Reflect, Athos!
Ready money is scarce in these times, and we should learn to make sacrifices. Go, D'Artagnan, go! Grimaud shall bear you company with his carbine. Half an hour afterwards, D'Artagnan returned with the 2,000 livres, no accident having befallen him on the way. It was thus that Athos found, without giving himself any trouble, resources which he did not expect. 39. A Charming Vision. At the appointed hour, the four friends were reunited at the house of Athos. Their anxiety about equipment had entirely disappeared, and their faces no longer bore the marks of any but their own secret care. For behind all present happiness, there lurks some fear about the future. Suddenly Planchet entered, bearing two letters addressed to D'Artagnan. One was a little note, delicately folded lengthwise, with a pretty seal of green wax, on which was depicted a dove bearing a green bough. The other was a large square envelope, glittering with the terrible arms of His Eminence, the Cardinal Duke. At sight of the little letter, D'Artagnan's heart bounded, for he believed that he recognized the writing. And though he had only seen that writing once, the memory of it was engraven in his heart's core. So he took the note and unsealed it hastily. "Walk out," it said, "about 6 or 7 o'clock on Wednesday evening next, on the Chaillot Road, and look carefully into the carriages as they pass. But as you value your own life, or that of someone who loves you, do not speak, do not make one motion which may show that you have recognized her who exposes herself to every ill, only to see you for an instant." There was no signature. "It is a snare," said Athos. "Do not go, D'Artagnan." "And yet," said D'Artagnan, "I think that I know the writing well." "But it may be feigned," said Athos. "At 6 or 7 o'clock, at this season, you would be as solitary on the Chaillot Road as if you went to walk in the forest of Bondy." "But what if we should all go?" said D'Artagnan. "Surely they could not eat us all four, besides the four servants, the horses, and our arms. The act would certainly bring on a fit of indigestion. Besides, it will be a fine opportunity to display our equipments," said Porthos. "But if it is a woman who writes," said Aramis, "and this woman does not wish to be seen, consider that you compromise her, D'Artagnan, which is not becoming in a gentleman."
"We will remain behind," said Porthos, "and he can advance alone."
"Yes, but a pistol shot is easily fired from a carriage going at full speed."
"Ah!" said D'Artagnan. "It would miss me, and we would then overtake the carriage and exterminate whoever might be in it. It would be still so many enemies the fewer." "He is right," said Porthos. "Let us give battle. Besides, we needs must try our arms."
"Faith, let us give ourselves this treat," said Aramis, in his soft and careless way.
"Just as you please," said Athos.
"Gentlemen," said D'Artagnan, "it is now 4:30. And we have but just time to get to the Chaillot Road by 6. "Besides, if we go out too late, no one will see us," said Porthos, "and that would be a sad pity. Let us get ready, gentlemen."
"But this second letter," said Athos, "you forget that. And yet I fancy the seal indicates that it is worth opening. As for me, I confess, my dear D'Artagnan, that I think much more of it than of that little gewgaw which you so gently bestowed just now over your heart." D'Artagnan grew crimson.
"Well," said the young man, "let us now see what His Eminence wants with me."
D'Artagnan opened the letter and read, "Monsieur D'Artagnan of the King's Guards, of Monsieur des Essarts' company,
is expected at the Cardinal's palace at 8 o'clock this evening. Laudinière, captain of the guards.
The devil, said Athos. Here is an appointment, not a whit less disquieting in other respects than the first.
I will go to the second on returning from the first, said D'Artagnan. One is at 7, the other at 8. There will be time enough for both.
I would not go, said Aramis. A gallant gentleman cannot decline an appointment made by a lady, but a prudent gentleman may excuse himself from waiting on his eminence, particularly when he has some reason to believe that he is not sent for to listen to compliments.
I am of Aramis's opinion, said Porthos.
Gentlemen, replied D'Artagnan, I have already received a similar invitation from his eminence through Monsieur de Cavois. I neglected it, and the next day a great misfortune happened to me. Constance disappeared. Whatever may be the result, I will go.
If you are determined, said Athos, do it.
But the Bastille, said Aramis.
Bah, you will get me out again, rejoined D'Artagnan.
Certainly, replied Aramis and Porthos with the greatest coolness, as if it had been the simplest thing in the world. Certainly we will pull you out again, but as we must be off the day after tomorrow, you would do better not to run the risk of getting in.
Let us do better, said Athos. Let us not leave him throughout the evening. Let each of us, accompanied by 3 musketeers, wait at a gate of the palace. If we see any closed carriage that looks suspicious coming out, we will fall upon it. It is a long time since we have had a crow to pluck with the cardinal's guards, and Monsieur de Treville must think us dead.
Decidedly, Athos, said Aramis, you were cut out for the general of an army. What do you say to the plan, gentlemen?
Splendid, cried the young men in chorus. I have got no horse, said D'Artagnan, but I can go and take one of Monsieur de Treville's.
That is unnecessary, remarked Aramis. You can have one of mine.
How many have you, then? Inquired D'Artagnan.
3,
replied Aramis, smiling.
My dear fellow, said Athos, you are certainly the best paid poet in France.
Or in Navarre, added D'Artagnan.
But listen, my dear Aramis, said Athos. You will not know what to do with 3 horses, will you? I do not understand, indeed, why you have bought 3.
Nor did I, in fact, buy more than 2, replied Aramis.
Did the 3rd come from the clouds, then?
No. The 3rd was brought to me this morning by a servant without livery, who would not tell me from whom he came, and who merely said that he had been ordered by his master,
or his mistress, interposed D'Artagnan.
That makes no difference, said Aramis, colouring, and who merely said that he had been ordered by his master, or his mistress, to put this horse in my stable without telling me from whom it came.
It is only to poets that such things happen, gravely remarked Athos. Well then, in that case we can do better, said D'Artagnan. Which of the 2 horses will you ride, Aramis, that which you bought or that which was given to you?
That which was given to me, without doubt. You understand, D'Artagnan, that I could not so affront
the mysterious donor, added D'Artagnan.
Or the mysterious donatrix, said Athos.
Then that which you bought becomes of no use to you.
Almost so.
You chose it yourself?
And with the greatest care. The safety of the horseman, you know, depends almost always on his horse.
Well, then, let me have him at the price you gave.
I was going to offer you this trifle, my dear D'Artagnan, giving you your own time to repay me.
And how much did he cost you?
800 francs.
Here are 40 double pistoles, my dear friend, said D'Artagnan, taking that sum from his pocket. I know that it is the same piece in which you are paid for your poems.
You are in cash, then?
Rich, rolling in wealth, said D'Artagnan, rattling the rest of his pistoles in his pocket.
Send your saddle, then, to the Hotel of the Musketeers, and your horse shall be brought here with ours.
Very well. But it is almost 5 o'clock. Let us make haste.
In about 1/4 hour afterwards, Porthos appeared at the end of the Rue Ferou on a magnificent Spanish horse. Mousqueton was following him on a small but strong horse from Auvergne. Porthos was radiant with joy and pride. At the same time, Aramis was seen at the other end of the street, mounted on a superb English steed.
Bazin followed on a roan horse, leading a vigorous Mecklenburgian horse, which now belonged to D'Artagnan. The two musketeers met at the door. Athos and D'Artagnan were looking at them from the window.
"By my faith," said Aramis, "you have a grand horse there, my friend."
"Yes," replied Porthos. "It is the one that was to have been